Major funding for NJ Spotlight News is provided in part by NJM Insurance Group, serving the insurance needs of residents and businesses for more than 100 years, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com, and by the PSCG Foundation.
Tonight on NJ Spotlight News, the second week of the Menendez federal corruption trial is underway. Prosecutors and the defense questioning the alleged whistleblower in the case, diving deeper into the senior senator's role in a lucrative halal monopoly. Plus, NJ Decides 2024, a dozen candidates officially throw their hat into the ring to succeed the late Congressman Donald Payne Jr.
You have gubernatorial politics that play in here, Mikey Sherrill, Roz Baraka, Josh Kahnheimer, Steve Fuller, whoever may or may not be endorsing Union County. That plays into this election.
Also, state legislators move forward with a series of bills to stop deep fakes, looking for ways to keep your image or voice from being manipulated or altered.
I think it would act as a deterrent to potential people who are thinking about creating this kind of content.
And nearly 1,000 middle school students head to the beach for some hands-on learning.
This is like a great experience for me and my peers, because since we're not really close to all this stuff, I feel like this is like a one-in-a-lifetime chance.
NJ Spotlight News begins right now.
From NJPBS Studios, this is NJ Spotlight News with Brianna Venosi.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us this Monday night. I'm Raven Santana in for Brianna Venosi. Week two of Senator Menendez's federal corruption trial began, and back on the stand is the alleged whistleblower in this case, USDA agricultural attaché to Egypt, Brett Tate. The heart of his testimony, focusing on the halal meat export monopoly, prosecutors allege the senior senator worked to arrange. Tate testifying to emails he saw from Menendez to the Undersecretary of Agriculture back in 2019, talking about the Egyptian beef situation. Menendez, according to prosecutors, received bribes from co-defendant Will Hanna to help seal the monopoly deal. Today, defense lawyers got their shot at Tate, spending much of the day trying to discredit him. Ted Goldberg has been in the courtroom all day and joins us with the latest. Who is this whistleblower, Brett Tate, and what is his connection to the case?
Hi, Raven. So Brett Tate was the agricultural attaché to the American embassy in Cairo. Basically, he was a diplomat acting in America's interests, particularly the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And the way that he got involved in this case was that he noticed that a monopoly was forming as to the only company that could certify halal or kosher meat to Egypt for export. Remember, any meat that's sold to Egypt must be halal, otherwise it's not being purchased and it's not being exported over there. So he noticed the monopoly forming in 2019. Originally, there were four certifiers, four American companies that could provide halal certificates for meat sold in Egypt. But over the course of not a long time, it went from four companies to just one company. And the one company was not a previous certifier. It was ISEG Halal, a company operated by businessman Will Hanna, that's at the center of this whole scandal, this whole mess. And ISEG Halal was a company that did not have any previous background in halal slaughter. They did not have any background in halal exporting. That was according to Tate's testimony. He noticed over the course of 2019 that Egyptian officials and folks who were in charge of the halal company had a very cozy relationship, which he thought was a little suspicious, considering he says he never got a good answer from the Egyptian leaders why they wanted a monopoly in importing halal meat and why that company had to be ISEG Halal.
First day, the defense had a crack at him. Ted, what was their line of questioning? They were trying to discredit him, right?
There was one big piece of information that they tried to get all over him. One of the very first things that Tate testified was that the number of people who work at American embassies is sensitive but not classified information, meaning it is not information that they want divulged to the general public. Tate mentioned terrorism as a possible reason why that information should be kept secret. Again, sensitive but not classified. The defense, however, contended that if you knew where to look, those numbers were available publicly. If you went to the right website, anybody with an internet connection could have found these numbers. Now, what the prosecution argued, and Tate also argued, that the numbers available online were out of date and therefore inaccurate. But this was something that the defense had brought up. It was part of the indictment that the Menendezes had communicated how many people were at the embassy, therefore possibly putting lives in danger.
All right, Ted, and the final witness for the prosecution today, a lawyer with Will Hanna's Halal Company. Tell me about that.
So John Moldovan only worked there for 6 months, but it was a very eventful 6 months because in that time, they went from a startup company that wasn't really doing a whole lot with just a couple of employees to making more than $300,000 in certificate income the first month that they were operating. Also, according to emails that Moldovan had sent to the government of Uruguay, the Halal Company was acting as a government company on behalf of Egypt's government, which is something that, you know, it's been very nebulous in this trial. ISEG, the Halal Company at the center of this, are they a private company? Are they part of Egypt's government? Are they a company acting on behalf of the government? If these emails are true, and allegedly they were written at the request of Mr. Hanna, then that would certainly make it seem like that this is a company acting at the behest of Egypt's government, and something that, you know, could play a very huge role in this trial as it plays out.
A lot of interesting developments. Thank you so much, Ted. 11 candidates are throwing their hat in the ring for the late Donald Payne Jr. seat in the 10th Congressional District. Among them, the president of Newark City Council and a former staffer for Congressman Payne and many more. The special primary will be on July 16th, and the general election is set for September 18th. Senior political correspondent David Cruz has a story on what's shaping up to be a crowded field.
Back in the olden days, when a thing called the party line existed, filling the seat of a deceased member of Congress was a Soviet swift act of machine politics. But in the first primary in the post-party line era, Congressional District 10 has drawn almost a dozen candidates. You'd never see that in the party line years.
Voter apathy is something that's happening across the country, and every state or community has their role to play in that. But in New Jersey, the line has been the source of what I believe voter apathy, because people don't have options and people are discouraged, you know, with running because somebody didn't choose me.
Candidates like Brittany Claybrooks say it's a brand new day. And it's not like these 11 candidates are all just gadflies. Claybrooks is a planning director in Plainfield and a former East Orange City Council member. LaMonica McIver, the favorite, is a Newark City Council president. Jerry Walker is a Hudson County commissioner. There's mayors and state officials and a lot of smart people running.
The Payne family, I would believe they had this position at least 40 years, I think. So it was an opportunity. And then it also, you know, speaks to, you know, people that really want to get involved, that couldn't get involved before because of the line politics.
Phil Elijah, the chief of staff to the Essex County executive and a longtime party player there, backs LaMonica McIver, as does the Essex County Democratic Organization. But, he says, in an election in the middle of summer with no top of the ticket, the party organization will have its work cut out for it just to get people to pay attention.
Absolutely. And again, it's a strange dynamic, this race, because of redistricting. You have three different counties that are involved. So you may have the Hudson County Democratic Organization endorse somebody else. You have gubernatorial politics that play in here. Mikey Sherrills, Roz Baraka, Josh Gonheimer, Steve Fuller, whoever may or may not be endorsed in Union County. That plays into this election.
The race has already seen its first court case. Claybrooks has mounted a legal challenge to McIver's nominating petitions, which, if successful, could derail the Newark councilwoman's candidacy before it even begins. It's a petition challenge that would have been unheard of when the machine was handling all that paperwork.
This is this brave new world where, in candidate-centered campaigns, it is the candidate who is putting this stuff together. It is the candidate who is circulating the petition. And maybe it's her mom who's circulating it. Maybe it's her chief of staff who's circulating it. But it is not the apparatus of the party itself that is making sure everything's buttoned up. And so you're going to have these mistakes that are going to happen as we ramp up to this new system in which candidates are at the middle of everything. It's not the party organizations that are at the middle of everything anymore.
And just to be clear, the candidate who wins this primary on July 16th will then run in the special general election in September. The winner would fill the rest of Payne's term, a few months' worth in Congress. But as for who will be on the ballot for a full term in November's regular general election, the party decides that, regardless of who wins the primary. Technically, I'm David Cruz, NJ Spotlight News.
New Jersey is increasing penalties on nursing homes that repeatedly violate state regulations, strengthening programs designed to reward quality care, and investing heavily in expanding the long-term care workforce. These changes were born out of recommendations from a report released by the State Nursing Home Task Force in April. So how are the changes impacting the industry, and is it enough? To discuss that and more, I'm joined by healthcare reporter Lilo Stainton. Lilo, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Raven, for having me.
You know, no doubt we have seen long-standing problems amongst more than 230 licensed nursing homes in the state during COVID especially. But now there is $50 million being allocated to funding reforms. What kind of reforms are we talking about?
Sure. Well, a lot of this would go to a quality incentive program that is designed to encourage nursing homes to do the right thing when it comes to higher staffing levels, avoiding things like bed sores and falls, which are closely related to staffing. And that's just part of it. That's part of a Medicaid program. But it's, you know, the state has taken a lot of different steps. You know, the according to Human Services, they've invested more than $100 million in staffing efforts to try to build back a workforce on the front lines in nursing homes and home health care. But, you know, one of the things that the report pointed out, this is the state's long-term care task force, is that no matter what we do at nursing homes, 8 out of 10 people prefer to age, or if you're talking about someone who might have a disability, prefer to live at home or in their community in some kind of smaller group home type situation. So the question is really, what can the state do to move more people to that model?
Right, right. We know it's expensive. It's not easy.
And the other thing is, you're absolutely right, it's expensive, and there's a huge lack of affordable housing in general. So with a lack of housing for programs like this, or people that might need, you know, to be government funded for that housing, is really hard to do. So yeah, it's a challenge for sure.
Well, going back to the reforms, are they working then? Is this enough?
Well, I think it's a little too soon to tell on a lot of this because a lot of this is new, you know, but some of these are pretty novel. For example, the state has, it has a law where 90% of the Medicaid money spent, the dollar has to go to direct care. How that's defined is always a challenge. But one of the challenges that the report also points out is, you know, enforcement of this is up to state inspectors. And the Department of Health has been struggling with staffing issues throughout its ranks and in some parts. And this is one of their issues. They have a lot of vacancies in inspectors. So not all nursing homes are being checked on as frequently as, you know, advocates for residents would like. And that's a, you know, again, it comes back to money. The state is looking to put, you know, I think around $5 million into more staffing at DOH. So that's important. But, you know, it's a process.
You know, just staying on the topic of Medicaid, you know, when we think about that, what are the biggest challenges? What is being recommended to solve that problem?
Yeah, well, the report talks about how, you know, so there are about 68,000 roughly people in Medicaid who are receiving these long-term support services. And that means either just under 24,000 who are getting them in a nursing home. And that's, I think, 6 or 7 out of 10 nursing home beds is funded through the state and federal Medicaid program. Another 45,000 or so, a little less than, are getting those supports in the community. So numbers wise, they're already, we're supporting more people at home than we are in nursing home. The thing is, you know, the report said we'd like to move at least another 10,000 from nursing homes into community housing in the coming few years. And to do that, you really have to rethink housing.
Yeah, a lot of work still needs to be done. Lilo, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Raven.
In the world of artificial intelligence technology, deepfakes are becoming more and more of an issue. Sometimes they're used on politicians and celebrities to deceptively show them saying something they didn't or looking a certain way. But they've also been used to target women and girls in unflattering ways. The Assembly today considering bills that would hopefully prevent deepfakes and hold perpetrators accountable. Senior correspondent Joanna Gagas reports from Trenton.
It is here now, right? And we need to figure out how we can alleviate what's going on.
What's going on are deepfakes, video, image, and audio files that are manipulated to show a person doing or saying something that never actually happened. A package of bills with bipartisan support is moving through the legislature to address it. Today, several were up for a vote in the Assembly Judiciary Committee.
We spend billions of dollars a year trying to fight the perpetrators for hacking, phishing, ransomware. And, you know, it really takes a toll not only on the individual, but also as a community, as society.
One bill would make the production or distribution of deepfakes a third-degree crime and would give victims of the deepfake the ability to take civil action against the perpetrator. Kara Alimo is an associate professor of communication at Fairleigh Dickinson University who thinks this bill will have impact.
I think it would act as a deterrent to potential people who are thinking about creating this kind of content if they knew that they could be held criminally and then civilly liable.
That bill also requires any manipulated video include a disclosure. A disclosure was also included in another bill, A2818, that forbids distribution of any politically motivated deepfake about a candidate 90 days before an election.
It's really important to let our voters know that, you know, if video or a photo has been manipulated, altered in any way, we as a voter have a right to know that that's been the case. And I don't think it takes much to say, you know, put a disclosure on there that this is not the actual, you know, image and that it's been altered, right? And that's all it takes. So I think voters deserve the truth.
Alimo wants to see something similar at the federal level.
I think what we really need at a national level is legislation that requires that content that's created by AI be watermarked, and then also prohibits the removal of those watermarks. And that would be really important because, of course, it would send a signal to people that what they were looking at is false.
Another bill voted on today, A2364, allocates $2 million to create a unit under New Jersey's Department of Law and Safety called the Deep Fake Technology Unit. The two Republicans on the committee abstained from the vote, with Assemblyman Robert Auth saying he does support the notion of the bill, but
$2 million, and we really don't have a, I guess, detailed examination of how perpetrators are going to be located. Many of them are going to be outside of the country. I mean, once they are detected, they just move on to another IPN and they're off to the races again. I mean, it's just going to be a constant hide and seek, so to speak. And somewhere along the line, we need to know how they're going to be punished, how they're going to be fined.
Unfortunately, I mean, that's the state of how hacking and ransomware and all of this that's happening with the internet and computers now. So it's not just, you know, the deepfakes, but it's every aspect of the internet that keeps changing and moving.
The legislators agreed to keep working on the how aspects of the bills, even as each of them cleared committee. In Trenton, I'm Joanna Gagas, NJ Spotlight News.
A group of eight shore towns is going to court again to try and block construction of the Atlantic Shores offshore wind project. The Atlantic Shores plan calls for 200 wind turbines, some as close as 9 miles from Long Beach Island. The shore towns, Long Beach Township, Beach Haven, Ship Bottom, Barnegat Light, Surf City, Harvey Cedars, Brigantine, and Ventor, have long opposed the project because of tourism concerns. The new lawsuit challenges a Department of Environmental Protection decision Commission last month, which found Atlantic Shore's construction plan meets state standards. The towns also sued the DEP in December with accusations that agency officials were biased when approving the Atlantic Shores project. That lawsuit was tossed by a trial judge. The towns are now appealing the dismissal as well. Turning to Wall Street, stocks ticked higher today, looking for another record close. Here's how the markets fared for the day.
Support for the Business Report is provided by Riverview Jazz, presenting the 11th Annual Jersey City Jazz Festival, May 29th to June 2nd. Event details, including performance schedules and location, are online at jerseycityjazzfestival.com.
Nearly 1,000 middle school students got a chance to become marine scientists for a day as part of Clean Ocean Action's 26th annual summit in Sandy Hook. The summit included six different hands-on stations and 11 field activities, including lessons on everything from horseshoe crabs to ocean pollution. The unique field trip is designed to provide middle school students who come from different areas of the state with an opportunity to experience hands-on marine environmental education at the Jersey Shore. Staff and students I spoke with say the goal is to inspire future marine scientists.
So the first neat thing about them is they have been on the planet for over 450 million years.
Nearly 1,000 middle school students, grades 5th through 8th from 32 different schools, got a unique lesson in marine life at the 36th annual Clean Ocean Action Spring Student Summit. The two-day free summit that focuses on the importance of environmental preservation took place at the Gateway National Recreational Area in Sandy Hook.
So they're going to be going out onto field trips by professional field trip leaders from organizations like the American Littoral Society and other organizations. And then they're going to be, so that's going to be part of their day. And then the other half of their day are going to be these round tables where they get lessons on how to be good stewards of the environment that they're learning about today.
The kids definitely learn more than they did before. Some of these kids have never even seen horseshoe crabs before. So it was pretty cool to watch them field them and everything.
The summit included six different hands-on stations and 11 field activities, including lessons on ocean pollution and how to properly handle different species.
I'm also really passionate about terrapins, and I enjoy working with them, and I'm excited to teach kids about terrapins and other species here on Sandy Hook.
We get middle school students out to the beach to learn from experts and, you know, the people that do this stuff for a living and really connect with these marine-based lessons. We also have high school students from the Marine Academy of Science and Technology, MAST, which is out here on Sandy Hook. And these high school students come and also teach lessons, which is so great to kind of pass on the ripple effect of environmental advocacy and inspire students that are not too far in age from them.
And this is our sea urchin. I named him Spike. And he had a rough day because a starfish tried to eat him. We go to school out here, so there's a lot of opportunities for us to be like in the environment, so on the beach, on the boat. Like obviously we're in Sandy Hook, so there's a bunch of trails, so it's really important. We learned to really appreciate it as our 4 years went by.
And in addition to education, the workshops also provided exposure, especially to students who attend inner city schools.
So for us, it took us about an hour to get here. And, you know, just the change of scenery, just the change of environment. And, you know, they weren't experiencing, we were up there and it was warm. And down here, it's windy and cold. So it's definitely a great experience where they get to see some of the high schoolers that are here and they're on their way into high school. They can see what their future paths are. They can maybe see what they were not even thinking of as a career path.
It's just like a great experience for me and my peers, because since we're not really close to all this stuff, I feel like this is like a one-in-a-lifetime chance. I think the most interesting thing that I heard is that how horseshoe crabs were used as a bait, and how their numbers are really going down and how they're harmless to humans.
Staff says the goal is to inspire future marine scientists. The spring summit focuses on districts in northern and central New Jersey. The next summit will happen in fall on Island Beach State Park and focuses on the southern part of the state and Cape May. For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Raven Santana. That does it for us tonight, but don't forget to download the NJ Spotlight News podcast so you can listen anytime. I'm Raven Santana for the entire NJ Spotlight News team. Thanks for being with us. Have a great evening, and we'll see you back here tomorrow night.
New Jersey Education Association, making public schools great for every child. RWJ Barnabas Health, let's be healthy together. And New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com.
NJM Insurance Group has been part of New Jersey for over a century. We support our communities through NJM's corporate giving program, supporting arts and culture-related and nonprofit organizations that serve to improve the lives of children, rebuild communities, and help to create a new generation of safe drivers. We're proud to be part of New Jersey. NJM, we've got New Jersey covered.
I'm very grateful that I'm still here.
That's me and my daughter when we went to celebrate our first anniversary.
With a new kidney, I have strength.
They gave me a new lease on life.
I'm still going everywhere and exploring new places.
Nobody thought I was going to be here. Nobody.
And I look forward to getting older with my wife. That's possible now.
We're transforming lives through innovative kidney treatments, living donor programs, and world-renowned care at two of New Jersey's premier hospitals.
They gave me my normal life back. It's a blessing.
RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together.